We're going to do chapter 4 and 5 of this book tonight. Does anybody have any comments or questions or thoughts about these chapters of the previous ones? Yes.
Well, just a general thing.
Uh-huh.
I was telling Steve the other night, I am just so impressed by Swami's knowledge about so much. I mean, you know, all these guys that he's talking about and government, and I mean, it's so broad. It's really almost... It's really amazing, and he's so clear. The clarity of what he says. It's simple, but it's clear. You know,
it is.
You could be easily fooled because it's so clear.
No. What you're saying is that there's a connection in people's mind between something being hard to understand and it being profound.
Yeah.
And the fact that Swami works so hard to make it simple makes people think that it's simplistic when it's not at all. Or you just read right through it and it seems so easy to read you don't realize what's been implied. This is a very interesting chapter in that respect for exactly those reasons. Any other? Yes, Steve?
No, and that's really the thrust of one of his arguments that in one of those two chapters, for instance, somebody saying, well, it's Plato. It's You have to believe it. It must be true. He's such a deep thinker and you can probably expand that to many of the people to whom he refers.
Yeah, Swami's very much into the emperor is not wearing any new clothes. This particular chapter, Ask First, Will It Work, is a really important chapter for that kind of thinking. He's really taking on a real sacred cow of people's intellectual thinking, intellectuality, and it's a very important chapter to understand and develop the strength of will and of character to think through. Let me try to put it in context. Is there any more comments or questions before I do this? You know, one of the realities that as devotees of this path we have to work with all the time is really developing a faith and appreciation for what Master taught us and recognizing that it is sufficient and that we don't have to be impressed by other important individuals or feel that just because something is widely regarded or highly accepted or touted or something like that, that there must be something wrong with us if we don't appreciate it. I got an F on, it was my first F in college, on the paper I was supposed to write about Plato's Republic. I can't claim now it was because of any great insight. I think it was more that I was out partying and I didn't want to write it. I wrote an alternate essay instead of writing on the subject because the subject just bored me. I couldn't get interested in that. That's all I really remember is that I was unable to read it. Now, I don't even remember why, but I was very unable to read it. I was extremely interested in other things, so I wrote an alternate essay and got an F, which I thought was really not very nice because the other essay was pretty good. And somehow I had justified it. The details of it escaped me. But I've always found it hard to read things that weren't... relevant, that didn't have some deep meaning. Of course, I quit college altogether because it wasn't relevant. It was just very, very much of a... I was just rereading Swami's own autobiography about just the same thing, which is getting involved in this academic inclination to feel the need to be always objective and having that objectivity be such a value that it means that you're never committed. And that you always have to consider the possible reasonableness of things even when they're ridiculous. And Swami takes on here, he takes on Plato's Republic and he takes on communism and just sort of goes at them from a most common sense point of view, but you realize how few people really approach anything in their lives from a very practical point of view. One of the things in the early years of Ananda, back in the late 60s and the early 70s, when there was like a whole magazine devoted to communities and there was a whole movement about communities. There was just this whole big energy about intentional communities that were starting. No one would ever pay attention to Ananda. And we couldn't get anybody to take us seriously. And I remember I've shared with some of you when I went to a conference up in Oregon. This was many years ago. And it was a conference about communities, and I was there representing Ananda. And I had a whole slideshow about Ananda, and I mean, I was entirely qualified to speak about it. And I couldn't get anybody to listen to me or to put me on any of the programs or anything. I mean, we literally sat for an hour and a half and listened to these people talk about land they hope to purchase, pictures of land they hope to purchase, and their ideas for how they might build a community. And all of that was done much more seriously than I could get anybody to listen to us. There were two reasons for that. One of them was, I've explained to you, I spoke to Peter Caddy, who was the founder of Findhorn at the time, and I sort of said to him, why are people so disinterested in what I have to offer? And his answer was very astute, and he was contrasting Ananda to Findhorn, and he said, Findhorn promises heaven on earth, and Ananda demands that you transcend earth in order to achieve heaven. He said, and naturally our promise is more popular. And he was honest enough to admit it, that it was more popular. The problem is, of course, it's not a real promise. It's not a practical promise, and it doesn't work. But all throughout the ages, people have been much more interested in a beautiful theory than they have been in something that actually has a tangible reality. And Ananda was greatly criticized in the early years for not being radical enough. We were just following a basic economic system. People owned their own property. They got paid money. They had their little houses. They paid rent. It was like when people looked at it from the outside, they couldn't see a revolution in it. They could just see a continuation of business as usual, and they were much more interested in people who promised, like Peter Caddy said, they were promising that they were going to just transform everything and it was going to be completely different and it would be a world like no one had ever seen before. And Swami just wasn't making any such promises. He was promising that things would be a little better. In fact, he wasn't promising anything at all. He was inviting us to serve God, and that was going to be its own reward. But it was so such a good example. And for those of us associated with Ananda, sometimes it was very, very confusing. It was always confusing to me, because instinctively, I've always been so exceedingly practical that I've always been just instinctively very suspicious of people whose promises are not grounded in practicality. And that is sort of one of the characteristics of Ananda people. We're just much more interested in will it work. We're not nearly so interested in people who come to Ananda who have this intellectual fascination with all these different ideas that are not grounded in the day-to-dayness, usually get bored with us and go away. And we invariably get bored with them and do not necessarily mourn when they go away. Because there really are two different kinds of people. There are people who like to roll up their sleeves and do something that really happens, and then there's other people who like to dream. And sometimes they overlap. Sometimes people with dreamy ideas nonetheless get power, as he describes at great length with the communist ideal. But he's trying to get us to learn how to think about what people say, and not to be too credulous merely because either authority or tradition or individuals sort of try to hand us this idea that it should be true and therefore it must be true. The question always is not how beautifully it can be spun out, but whether there's an actual practical dimension to it. That's nearly a law of Ananda, is the phrase that Master said to Swami at a certain point in his early training. He said, quite simply, you have to be practical in your idealism. And that's a very simple point, but an extremely fundamental one. I recall that I had an interesting experience of that with a woman that I was trying to attract to Ananda. She never actually embraced the path and went off and did other things. But she was a young woman at that time, just graduating from Stanford, as it happened. And she was sort of looking at me, trying to figure out what direction to take with her own life. And she asked me the question, sort of, she was like challenging my choices in life. This was not very long ago, so I was essentially twice her age. And she asked me if I was happy. Now, of course, when you ask almost anybody if they're happy, they'll almost always say yes, because most people don't like to admit they're unhappy, or else they have simply reduced their concept of what happiness is to fit what they are. So it's not a very real question. So my first answer was, yes, of course I'm happy, But I didn't feel that that was really to the heart of her question. So I thought for a moment, and I gave her a very different answer. I said, you know, when I was her age at that time, I was very, very idealistic. I've always been very idealistic. I've always had the thought that great and wonderful things were possible in life, and that you didn't just have to end up nowhere. It was ironic dealing with this particular young woman because, just personal insights here, my great fear when I was growing up, when I was a teenager and then went briefly to college, was that I would end up married with children living in a suburb somewhere. And the epitome of my fear was that I would have one of those station wagons with the wooden sides. Just somehow, it epitomized to me just everything that I didn't want. I did, in fact, want to get married, and I did want to have children, but I didn't want to live that life. I wanted to have something else. So I was terrified that I would just end up there. I read even a note to myself that I was afraid I would marry a dentist. I don't know where that came from or not. Arati used to say that there were three girls in her family fairly close in age, and when most of the father's salary was going to straighten their teeth, the mother used to line the children up and have them repeat after her, "I will marry an orthodontist." They all have beautiful smiles at great expense at this point. And then this young woman that I was talking about, too, was very afraid that if she got too interested in what I was doing, she would end up without that station wagon and that house in the suburbs. It was sort of like a dichotomy that we were discussing. She had this dream, and she was afraid she would lose it, and to me it had always looked like a prison, and I was hoping I would escape for it. I mean, we have to learn one of Swami's fundamental themes here from the beginning of the book is that the main thing that's wrong with so many of these theories is that they fail to take into account how individual people are. And do you recall the first chapter we were talking about that one point that Swami was coming down to, that there seems to be no meaning because it all can go in so many different directions. But what that's really saying is that it all begins from the individual. And that if we start all of our understanding about society and culture and communities from the individual, then the whole model follows. But if we don't, everything becomes a travesty, and that's how he describes communism in this one. But what I said in any case, back to this woman, was that I'm a very idealistic person, and I feel that in my life I have never had to compromise. And that I've never, from the beginning to the moment I am now, felt that I've had to betray my ideals in order to make my life work. And I think that's quite remarkable. And that's not really about me, that's really about the teachings of self-realization. That's not to say that exactly the same ideas that I started with I still have, but they're not really very far away either. I've refined my understanding and my articulation of them, but they're not really that different. Because it really is a system that works. It's a very practical set of ideals, and it's a set of ideals that's based entirely on the individual and all of life focusing back to that source point, which is what we do with our own consciousness. Last night in our satsang group, we were talking about the Vaishya, we were talking about politics, we were talking about Vaishya versus Kshatriya. These are the two caste levels that we progress through as we evolve. And the Vaishya level, which is the level of a merchant, is the way it's characterized, is the level at which we're always thinking about trading. We need something. If we're going to give, we need to get. But that wasn't the relevant point. The Vaishya level of consciousness thinks in this key way. The Vaishya level feels that its suffering is the result of external conditions which affect the way I feel, and therefore the avoidance of suffering comes from developing the willpower and the energy or whatever it might be to control and change external circumstances sufficiently so that I will no longer be in pain. Now, a great deal of social action and what passes for selflessness in trying to accomplish good things in the world, it's not necessarily bad, but it fundamentally is Vaishya in the way people are thinking. there's some anxiety, some suffering that's created by certain conditions, whether it's the proliferation of nuclear weapons, whether it's the fear that we're going to run out of oxygen, whether the ozone layer is going to be destroyed, whether the presence of homeless people makes me so anxious I have to do something about it. And that is not to say that good actions don't come out of the Vaishya level, but if the underlying attitude is that I'm suffering because of an external circumstance and I've got to change circumstances in order to feel safe, then we're always in a vulnerable position. Because no matter how dynamic you are, no matter how effective you can be against the world, ultimately we're not in charge. And there's a lot of New Age kind of thoughts now about how if we all just affirm together and enough of us affirm the right thing, and it's a very egocentric view of reality that somehow this whole creation is just dependent on our little human minds and we can just put them together. It doesn't take into account that there's a superconscious power, even our own superconscious power, that is not of the ego, that's really making this world happen. So part of the idealism that when I speak of myself that I have come to understand, but again, I was born with this to a certain extent. I mean, I had it when I was young. I only flirted for a short time with trying to make the world better because it seemed so self-evidently impossible. And I didn't want to be miserable. My entire intention throughout life is to not be miserable. And I've always been willing to at least try hard to do something to not be miserable. But then the realization that the real idealism is about changing our consciousness, and that's what the Kshatriya understands. The Kshatriya understands that I suffer because of my internal relationship to my experiences. And if I change my internal relationship, then the world can go on as it wishes, but that's the battle that I have to fight. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't participate in shifting the world, but you recognize that your happiness or unhappiness is never, you're never going to be safe just by making that world okay. You'll only be safe if you make your internal world okay. And even if you do get engaged in trying to improve the planet, which all of us are deeply engaged in at this point, you're doing it from the understanding that it's right for me to do, not that I will, unless I can make the world conform, I'll be happy. Now, Swamiji's question about will it work is really a lot about this. It's about not just spinning a theory that I hope I can impose on the world. And a lot of times, people who really don't want, or if we ourselves really don't want to engage in something that actually has nuts and bolts practicality, we get enamored of theories. And whether it's communism or Plato or just enamored of theories of how we really think things ought to be without ever just doing that really hard work to think about what is human nature and how does it really relate. And so Swami's whole discussion here over and over in this chapter about will it work is really a discussion of human nature. And the whole story of this whole book is really understanding what actually makes people tick. It's such a simple premise, which is if you're going to talk about any social system or any possibility of communities, it has to begin with the people involved. And when even in those early years of Ananda, Swami's theory was always this. I mean, he didn't have all these books so clearly articulated, written out in this form. He had it clear in his own mind, which is very simple. Systems do not create perfect people. You can get the most perfect system and it simply won't create perfect people. And that's why he talks about how grotesque is the word he uses at times. The whole communist ideal, the way it's intellectualized, as he puts it in the coffee houses and the living rooms of America and England, compared to the way it actually had to be acted out, because it was fraudulent from its inception. And because it just spun this theory of this praise for low consciousness and this praise for bringing everyone down to the lowest level without giving them anything to aspire to. And that anyone who really understands themselves or understands people around them will see that that just really won't bring about the kind of upliftment that it promises. And more than that, as he talks when he goes on to the further chapters, he just talks about the fact that, and this is where he said at the very beginning, the only thing, if the individual is the center, this was the first chapter that he was writing, you can't impose. Individuals will move according to their own reality. And that reality is completely eccentric. It can't be dictated by theories. And he talks about Plato's system. How could it ever work when everything is referred back to some idea that somebody has of it instead of looking first at the people? Throughout the years of Ananda,